All right, hello, friends and family. Really wonderful to have the hundreds of you from our growing Sapir community join us from around the world for today's installment of our special weekly Sapir conversation, where we delve into the subtext, the context, and the impact of the war between Israel and Hamas, which is now in its 27th day. So here's the deal. The other day, a buddy of mine from childhood texted me. He's an avowed man of the left. You know, ideologically, that's his home. It's where he feels most comfortable. And as an American Jew, that's really not abnormal. In fact, just the opposite, right? A vast majority simply identify themselves as left of center in terms of their political orientation. And that's been the reality for the last many decades. But something happened over the last few weeks that's given many individuals, like my friend, a pause. He texted me, "It feels kind of strange what's going on. There are those on the right," he was saying, "with whom he would otherwise never talk politics. Those individuals kind of expressed a certain solidarity with Israel and with the Jews that found comforting. And for him and many others, you know, Israel's existential safety is not something he's willing to compromise on. But for those on the left, well, just look at some of the headlines from the week after Hamas's massacre on October 7th. The New York Times blared, quote, "On Israel, progressive Jews feel abandoned by their left-wing allies." The Atlantic, "The progressives who flunked the Hamas test." There's a progressive writer in the New York Times named Michelle Goldberg who said the headline was "The Massacre in Israel and the Need for a Decent Left." The Forward had a piece with the headline, "Justifying Israeli deaths is anti-Semitic. Yet many of my progressive peers are doing just that." For my friend and many others, in the last few weeks, there have been a range of feelings, from being disoriented to being disconcerted to sense of being disturbed to a sense of being disgusted. And maybe it was the rally in Times Square where attendees celebrated the quote unquote resistance, just as we were learning what had transpired to the 1,400 individuals on the border of Gaza. Or is the group in Chicago that tweeted gleefully an image of a person paragliding with Palestinian flag attached to its parachute a clear reference to those members of Hamas who were part of this massacre and tried to paraglide into Israeli territory? Or is the statements from all the groups on college campuses, or is the absence of statements? You know, Gal Beckerman from The Atlantic, like many others, reflected that, quote, "After the brutal violence committed by Hamas against Israeli civilians, I look around for my friends on the left and I felt alone." It's kind of what Rabbi Sharon Brous from Ikar said on the Shabbat after. She called it, you know, an existential loneliness. Wait a second. We marched arm in arm to address gun violence and reproductive rights and to protect those within the LGBTI community and for voting rights because we believe deeply in all of those things. Why is there suddenly a disconnect when Israelis are killed en masse? The worst killing of Jews in a single day, as everyone has heard, since 1945, since the Holocaust. There's really a deep cognitive dissonance that's eating at many within the progressive community, myself included. So we have seen the headlines, we have seen the static quotes, we have read the articles and the essays, there have been a ton of them. But what we haven't seen yet is a conversation, a public discussion about what's transpiring, and a public discussion with individuals who operate in that space, who are constantly working within the progressive community and who are building coalitions. They have up until now, and they will from here on out. Let's hear their points of view. Let's ask them what their perspective is to help us make sense of this moment. And I got to tell you, I can't have selected two better individuals to join us for today's conversation. First is Sheila Katz, who is the CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women, known by, in shorthand, NCJW. It's a 130-year-old Jewish feminist civil rights organization, which has 210,000 advocates working for full equity and safety of women, children, and families in the United States and Israel. And Sheila is an important voice, not just because she leads NCJW, because also she was the vice president of student engagement and leadership at Hillel International for 12 years. So she understands what's happening on college campuses. She knows it well. This is not foreign to her. The second individual is Joel Rubin. Joel is currently running for Congress in Maryland's 6th Congressional District, but he has a wealth of experience in the progressive community, both in the foreign policy space and in the Jewish space. He's from Pittsburgh, so what transpired, and we'll talk about this, 5 years ago at Tree of Life resonates for him in a very deep, deep way. But he's a guy who served in the Peace Corps in Costa Rica, who's one of the founding political directors of J Street, who worked on the Hill for many years for Senator Harkin and Lautenberg. He spent time in the Department of State during the Bush administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary, also during in the Obama administration as a DAS, as we call it, in the Legislative Affairs branch. And he was one of the founding board members of Jewish Democratic Council of America. And he even spent 3 months as Bernie Sanders' Jewish liaison to the Jewish community during the 2020 presidential campaign. So we have two folks here who understand it, who get it, who speak with a moral clarity, and I think can help us sort of understand the current moment. So a little bit of a long-winded introduction, but really happy to have you, Sheila, and really happy to have you, Joel.
Thank you.
So,
thanks, Hanan. Thank you.
Joel, let's start with you, okay? I'm curious, as someone, I think, who very clearly identifies with the left and with the progressive community, help us make sense of what transpired within the community over, let's say, within the first week of the massacre on the 7th. What did you see? What was your reaction? How did you feel? Go ahead.
Well, before I start, I do also want to throw a shout out to you, Hanan, for your leadership. You're jumping in with all fours to Sapir, your leadership at the White House, your leadership as an advocate for human rights and democracy. Thank you. Thank you for all that you do. And thank you for organizing this incredibly valuable discussion. And of course, to Sheila, my dear friend, it's wonderful to see you. And you are a true champion for the Jewish people and women and all of us. So it's great to be on in conversation with you. So on October 7th, I think for me, as a progressive and as a Jew, I was caught flat-footed and deeply disturbed in the immediate moments of what was taking place on the ground in southern Israel. For background, as Hanan mentioned, I grew up in Pittsburgh. I have a lot of family in Israel. I went to Brandeis University and studied abroad at Tel Aviv University. So I have a deep connection to Israel on a personal level. In those early moments, I had reached out to some friends, some colleagues, people I've worked with in the space of support for diplomacy, support for some type of peaceful reconciliation between Israel and the Palestinians. And the reactions I got were heartbreaking and horrifying. Some of the reactions were when I said that they were killing young, innocent civilian women. You know, Joel, those women serve in the military. When I spoke with people about the fact that this was unprovoked, I got snarky responses about, what do you mean unprovoked? As a Jew, you know, as a fifth generation Pittsburgh Jew, who deeply cares about the survival of the Jewish people. To me, those were blood libels. Those were terms that brought up all of this sort of DNA of being Jewish and the fears and the concerns of survival at a very base level, and really brought out in me a sense of betrayal and a sense of fear about where this was going to be taking us. I think that what evolved after that in the days after also added to the sense of being alone in this space, in a sense. And I can speak to what you're referring to, Hanan, and your friend, and happy to get into that and sort of the partnership across the community. But the quiet in the first few days from people with whom I had worked extensively over the years was, I know the cliche is deafening. It was mind-blowingly deafening. I didn't get a call from anyone. I didn't get a call from my non-Jewish colleagues, people with whom I partnered for 15 years. I just got silence. And to me, the way I read that was the abomination of the mass murder of Jews in southern Israel that we all both watched from afar and are still learning about those atrocities. The abomination of that so undercut and damaged the progressive community's view of the conflict, which is that there is an oppressor and an oppressed, that it left the progressive community stone cold silent and unable to process the reality that the oppressed committed an atrocity. And that's a dangerous place to be. Yeah, I'll close with this and then hand it off to Sheila. As a progressive, my view, and as Hanan mentioned, I served in the Peace Corps. I started out always seeking to try to find ways, how do we promote global peace and security? My view of the progressive world and the foreign policy arena in particular is one that tries to seek peace and commonality and tolerance and engagement and diversity and builds partnerships and conducts difficult diplomacy and creates political fights in order to try to create space for policies that may not get everybody everything they want, but that gets a lot of people some of what they want enough to have a peaceful future. To me, I felt like the days after really undermined that partnership, and it brought up those suspicions and those concerns about whether or not really the allies with whom I depend on, whom I depended as a partner for years, had the same vision any longer about Israel and about the Jewish people. And I think we've only seen more difficult conversations and public demonstrations since that day.
Okay, I want to get into that in a second. For those of you who are new to Sapir, we're going to reserve the final, let's say, 15 minutes or so for questions. So please don't be shy. Send us your questions and we'll throw them to Joel and Sheila. Sheila, I'm going to get to you one second. Joel, did you what type of conversations transpired either behind the scenes or with some of your friends in the space? Did you ask them to say something? Did you not? Like, what was the behind the scenes conversation? What did that look like?
I mean, two themes. One is, why are you people quiet? Like, why are you not speaking out when an atrocity happens to Jews? Why are you not publicly and directly engaging with us? I must be a magnet for Jewish progressives behind the scenes, because I got so many calls from people who I've worked with who felt the same way, like abandoned. All of a sudden, we're not important anymore. We don't matter anymore. We're not worthy of support. The second one is conversations related to policy and politics, which it invariably always flips to in my space. And I found myself within moments, practically within days, certainly having debates with allies in the progressive community who were immediately laying the blame at Israel. You know, on the day of the murders, there were some groups that said it was Israel's fault for these murders directly while people were still getting killed. unconscionable statements. And the entities who work in these spaces that I'm referring to, all of a sudden we're trying to pivot to, well, how do we prevent Israel from retaliating? How do we stop this? How do we blame? Like all of those sort of weird political arguments when we're still suffering. Like we didn't have a moment to mourn. And all of a sudden we're in a defensive moment of trying to protect the reality that Jews should not be slaughtered in their sleep and that there's no justification for it. Those were the kinds of conversations I was having.
Thanks, Joel. Sheila, I want to sort of piggyback off of what Joel said. You are someone who, let me put it this way. There are many people out there who are deep critics of the Israeli government leading up to and currently the massacres, right? Because of the tremendous amount of frustration about the bills that were being passed, judicial reform bills that were being passed in the months leading up to October 7th, really over the past year. You're someone who stood in front of 200,000 people, one of the only American Jews who stood in front of 200,000 people to express the frustration with what was transpiring in Israel at the time. You've been to, you're in Israel frequently. You traveled, I think, a few weeks ago with the Conference of Presidents. What did you hear there in conversation for this most recent trip? And what happened on your way back? How did that influence or inform any conversations you had with those within your community or those within your broader coalition of partners?
Yeah, thanks, Hanan, and thanks for having me, and good to be here with Joel. Listen, these last few weeks have been impossible. And I just wanna start by saying that I think for the whole Jewish community, I think, you know, I'll talk about progressive Jews, but I want to name and hold and honor how hard this has been for Orthodox Jews and those who are visibly Jewish. Like I can blend in when I'm out and about in a way that not all Jews can. And I think there's an added gender layer here that I'm sure we can get to at some point of fears of Jewish women in this moment. You know, I also know personally four hostages. And so on any given day between October 7th and now, I'm crying at some points and doing everything and anything I can to try to get all of the hostages reunited with their loved ones. And the reason I went to Israel with Conference of Presidents is first they asked, you know, I thought with my heart, maybe more than my head, my mom was very angry at me for going into a war zone. And, but I went there to hug my friend Abby, who has three family members who are hostages right now. And I went there to be in solidarity with people I really care about who were on the receiving end of one of the most vicious, brutal attacks I can recall ever. And then after that happened, had to watch the world gaslight us and gaslight them and blame them. I'm a rape crisis counselor. I know a lot about victim blaming. I've seen it. And I also know that when people don't believe people, when things happen, when people you trust don't believe you, that you're actually more likely to have long-term negative mental health consequences as a result of it. So to understand on that day that rape was used as a tool of war, and then to hear people who claim to be feminists saying, but were they really raped? Or saying, well, like this was the resistance. My heart is broken in so many pieces. I have never heard anything like this from this community that has claimed to care about me for a long time. And what I can say clearly, and then I will give you a glimmer of hope, but what I can say clearly is that we should not have to convince our friends and allies that murdering Israeli civilians is wrong. Full stop, right? And to be clear, you are not a feminist if you can't feel for the Israeli civilian women, children, and babies who were murdered. And so I'm very angry about what I'm hearing in the secular progressive community, and I'm angry about what I'm hearing in the Jewish progressive community, which is a lot of nothing. And so I'm very glad I was on this trip with Conference of Presidents and with a lot of other organizations. I think the people who chose to come on this first, I would say, trip of American delegation afterwards were a lot of people personally impacted. We had a lot of people with kids in Israel. We had a lot of people with friends. We were there really in a way I've never seen as one voice, as one people, experiencing that together and hearing even more the atrocities of what happened that day. You asked me what happened on the way back. So some people know I left and timed my departure from Israel. I would have stayed longer. My mother was happy that I was leaving and coming back. But I timed my departure from Israel to make it in time to speak on the main stage of the Women's March Convention, which I had been invited to speak at previously. And for another time, another conversation, we should actually go through the amazing arc of the Women's March, which I think people associate are with anti-Semitism, which is true from several years ago, but they've gone on a long journey to actually unlearn a lot of that, change board members, do a variety of things to protect Jews, coming to these conferences. And actually me coming and speaking on the main stage was an important moment for NCJW's relationship with the Women's March after several years of kind of being in limbo in that way, but we stayed in that relationship. We felt good about where they were, and we were ready to be very visibly holding our hands with them. And to put this lightly, I was more scared about going to speak at the Women's March Convention than I was about going into a war zone. And my team with the Women's March, they were very good to me. We got additional security. We had a de-escalation team ready, right? There was no way I was going to speak on the main stage and not talk about Israel. And so then I did. I went. I spoke. I started with the people I know who are killed. I started then talked about the people I know who are hostages. And then I talked about how awful it has been to not feel people caring about the Jewish community, caring about me, somebody who's been there. And that we are not able to do the work we need to do on reproductive rights and voting. Like, we can't do that work if you're going to exclude Jews. And in all of the potential outcomes, I will say, Hanan, of what could have happened, interruption, protests, all the things, I did not have on the list what happened. I got a standing ovation of everyone who was there. And I will tell you, I left confused. I left confused because the people in that room, not everyone, right? I don't mean to paint the left in one swoop. You know, it's all more complex and nuanced than that. But a lot of people in that room, people I know, had been on social media sharing images that to me indicated they were comfortable with Jews being murdered from the river to the sea, right? The paraglider particularly pains me because that's where so much of the gang rapes occurred for young women. And then to see them standing and giving me a standing ovation and checking in on me and having that empathy, I was like, there is a disconnect here. And I will say it gave me a little bit of hope. And I think where NCJW is sitting right now is we do want to have a firm line. Like, and we don't usually have these lines, but there is a line. If you can't see that raping Jews is bad, like, that's it. We're not working with you. The end. And I think that's okay for us to say, and it has to be okay for us to say, because I don't want to put my staff in harm's way. But people who can have empathy for what happened and realize that they might be getting information, language that's problematic and not know the what and why behind that. Like, when I explain from the river to the sea and what that, how that lands for me, and people go, huh, you know, that's people that I think I can work with. And so I think where we're sitting right now is in this challenging place of not knowing fully where people are. And there are a lot of people on the left, you know, the ones tearing down those posters of the hostages, the ones going to pro-Hamas rallies. There is a group that we are going to have to say goodbye to. And there is another group that needs people like me, like Joel, and like others to sit and engage and talk about the trauma, talk about what happened, talk about, you know, the anti-Semitism underlying why they're so quick to believe Hamas, among other things. And I think this is just going to be a difficult road ahead, but I will say I had a glimmer of hope. I thought this was going to be my swan song from the Jewish community, for the progressive community, and the standing ovation was not something I expected. And I'm holding on to that for the work ahead.
I'm holding on to that too. Thank you, Sheila. I wanted to sort of piggyback off of that, maybe ask the two of you the following question. If that is the case, and that is encouraging, perhaps energizing, but is it your sense that there's just a different experience on social media than there is in person? That people are keyboard warriors and they're completely uneducated when it comes to certain nomenclature and they use it because they think they're standing for something, but in reality, they don't fully understand it. Or is that not the case? It's actually been, unfortunately, pretty synonymous in both online and offline worlds. Joel, you want to take that? And Sheila, you want to?
Want me to jump in on that one?
Yeah.
Social media is not the real world, without a doubt. But it has an impact on the real world and on how we perceive what's going on. And the challenge is to ensure that the dialogue and the discussion doesn't overwhelm online, doesn't overwhelm and become the new normal in reality. And I think about the campuses and the sort of dynamics now at universities where it seems like Jewish students are running for their lives, right? Running scared for supporting Israel or just for being Jewish, right? Just that basic line. I have had some horrific engagements and interactions with people online who I have felt were allies or peers, colleagues. Again, I've worked in the national security foreign policy community for about 15, 20 years in Washington. Got a network of people that I engage with and have put up anodyne posts from my perspective. One related to, for example, Joe Biden, who was called a warmonger. And I said, he's not a warmonger. And I explained my rationale. And boy, did I get it from people I know, right? So there are trolls out there that we don't know, and people who are random individuals who have positions, and that's appropriate. They can have those views, but that's not the organizing community in the progressive space that is engaging Congress and policymakers, that is trying to direct national strategies for moving issues. But when you know the people themselves and you see them directly, and you see what is being posted, that is a major red flag. And I think that's where, to Sheila's, excellent point, really rocky days ahead are coming. Because within the progressive space, part of being a Jewish, a pro-Israel, pro-peace Jewish national security person in my lane has been to work alongside allies who now are, in many instances, putting out very vitriolic statements about Israel. And you can't work in an environment where you don't have confidence that the other person has your back. Now, the unwritten rule has always been that we support each other. And in the sense of promoting diplomacy, there are different buckets that people pick up and that they manage and they communicate to. But I think a lot of that has broken as a result of this. And that's going to take a lot of repair work. And I say, I'll just close to this. I think it's really important. We can't have a good, healthy American political culture without a vibrant, forward-thinking, positive left, a progressive left that helps to shape the policymaking in this country. The Jewish community, as we all know, is significantly liberal. That's certainly a factor, but to have a really healthy politics, we have to have healthy conversation. And one of the concerns I had, and I spoke with an ally about this who's very significant in this space, is that if you kick out the Jews from the Jews who care about Israel from progressive coalitions, these progressive coalitions will have no political power and they will go down the rabbit hole of looking like anti-Semites. The price tag for a participating in progressive politics shouldn't be that the Jewish participants dismiss their support for Israel, move it to the side, no longer care. One should be able to support Israel and being Jewish and still be progressive. But that is now becoming a litmus test in progressive coalitions, certainly in the foreign policy space, that I think is very toxic, very dangerous, not just for Jews, but also for the actual ability of those in the progressive community to advance their ideas and look like they actually care about peace and tolerance and a positive, peaceful future. And so online, it feeds into it, but it's the people who are making these leadership decisions. That's where we are really in for rocky roads ahead.
Well, that's a really interesting point, right? To kick Jews out from a coalition ultimately ends up weakening the coalition. I think it's kind of comparable to kicking Jews out of a country ends up weakening that country. And we've seen that throughout our history. Sheila, you've had some experience, I think, in dealing with scenarios in which you've been kicked out or there have been like, unpack that a little bit. What happened 2 years ago with Sunrise DC boycott in 2021? How'd you navigate that? And share for our listeners what happened precisely.
Yeah, and let me just start. I'm gonna just jump back to the other question first, because I feel like as a millennial, I have to just at least say this, is that social media really matters to me. And I don't want to just dismiss what I see online as a thing that's online. And as somebody who has received multiple rape threats in the last several weeks, as a result of simply existing as a Jewish woman, I can tell you that what you see online can create real fear and trauma. And I think there's a new battleground in social media. And I think we have to be open and public about our Jewish identities for those who feel safe. I think we need more Jewish organizations to talk about their Jewishness, to talk about Israel and their Zionism. It feels isolating, even if you just map Jewish progressive organizations and mainstream organizations, and you look in the last several weeks of what's been said, right? There's a lot of people not saying anything still, and it puts a target on like a back of like National Council of Jewish Women that does engage on Israel. And so we need everybody to actually amplify louder in that way.
Can I push on that for a second? Yeah. To both of you, do you think organizations that don't have quote unquote foreign policy in their remit, should they speak out on this issue or not?
Like, yes. Yes, let me tell you why. Yes. Let me say why. And this is the issue, and this is what I've been saying to these groups. This was the largest mass murder of Jews since the Holocaust. Stop making this about a geopolitical issue. This is a humanitarian issue. This is about saying that Jews are worthy, are holy, are important. And this is about standing up for the 1,400 people who were murdered, tortured, raped, beheaded. The only way we stay in solidarity with each other and the only way we show love and empathy to our friends and family in Israel who suffered this mass atrocity and it happened so quickly before people even moved on and said it didn't even happen. The only way is by telling everyone you don't have to be an expert on war to at least say what happened on October 7th was bad. Like that, I don't need everybody to be weighing in on what the best policy is to release hostages or what the best policy is, you know, to have peace. Like that's complicated, nuanced. I'm happy for us to weigh in on it and Joel to weigh in on it. But what was missing in the reaction was outrage. Outrage that there was this terrorist attack that targeted Jews. We've seen more from the Jewish community and from progressive communities around like the Pulse nightclub, around other examples of horror and atrocity. And to see and notice the silence when it happened to Jews, we can't let Israel and geopolitics become an excuse to calling out terror, because then we create an environment where it can happen again and that we're not actually standing with the people who need us to. So I feel, as you can hear, I jumped in and cut you off. I feel very strongly that any excuse of silence is complicity, and any excuse of silence allows the bad behavior around anti-Semitism to become normalized, to permeate, and to create harm. And I'll tell you about Sunrise
and in a minute. And I do just want to second what Sheila's saying and just reiterate this point that there is a situation now that is developing and has been developing for a number of years, and Sheila's experience sort of dovetails with this, of a shedding of support for Israel by Jewish organizations to participate in progressive coalitions. That is not just grotesque and denies Jewish participants from being their true selves if they want to support Israel, but it also is incredibly self-defeating. From a progressive organizing perspective, to excommunicate Jews who support Israel undermines the entire objective of a progressive vision for the United States, the entire objective of a more peaceful world. You know, progressive community right now in the international space looks to make common cause with the global international support for human rights and trying to create a better world. Well, what were the human rights that were protected on October 7th? There were none. And the failure to call that out as a war crime and a human rights violation of the highest magnitude, full stop, to borrow Sheila's phrase, that undercut the moral high ground of the progressive space on foreign policy. That, and I'll cut to this. I counseled so many coalitions to please condemn the murders on their own. Do not make a yes, but. Do not make a context argument. There will be other things happening, as we see with the war now. There are a variety of areas to talk about different points. But on that one, if you can't have the moral clarity and freedom of language to denounce war crimes and mass murder and massacres of Jews, then you are losing your moral high ground, your ability to call yourself progressive.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna put a pause on that question about Sunrise, just because I've seen we have about like 50 questions that have already come in, which is great. Right. People are invested, they're interested in this conversation, as am I, and I wanna hear your responses to a couple of these questions. I have one first before we get to them, which is, you know, there was an op-ed, I think, from the dean of UC Berkeley Law School. Is the title, I think, something to the effect of like, nothing prepared me for the anti-Semitism I see on college campuses. We're in this weird environment right now where, like, historically in the past, if something transpired in Israel, typically, you know, those in the diaspora would call to check in on their friends and family and see how they're doing. I'm imagining, for example, the Intifada. And other times, if there's like an uptick in anti-Semitism or like an act of murder committed against Jews in the United States just 5 years ago, Squirrel Hill, you know, friends and family from Israel are calling, you know, folks here in the United States and beyond. What we're experiencing right now, to a certain extent, is sort of phone calls going in both directions. And it's such a unique moment in time, I think, for Jews around the world. And so I want to go to that original quote from the UC Berkeley Law School dean. Nothing prepared him for the anti-Semitism on college campuses. To what extent should we be surprised by what we're seeing now? Is this just an over-caffeinated version of what we've seen in the past? Or is this something entirely new? Sheila, you want to take this and then Joel?
Yeah, I think we've been seeing indicators that this could come for a long time. I think this is now kind of full blown in a way I think we had hoped wouldn't happen. But we can't, like, anti-Semitism on October 6th was at an all-time high, right? And now it's gone up over 400% since October 7th, and that's probably even outdated numbers in this last week. And so this, you know, this is the oldest form of hate in the book. It's been here. I think we've made a lot of excuses for it. I think it's been downplayed. I think we see it in K-12 and not just the college campus. And I think it has become normalized. And I think this was that final, you know, moment for us to see it. So, you know, as an organizer, one of the things you do is you don't deny the reality in front of you. You don't accept it if you want to change it, but you own that that's where things are in order to move them. And I can tell you, I just met with Secretary Cardona from the Department of Education this past week or last week. I don't know what day it is anymore, this past week. And you know, I talked to him about having worked for over a decade with the Department of Education on implementing Title IX around sexual assault, and that the Department of Education has a roadmap to implement Title VI, which is supposed to protect Jewish students. And it's exactly what they did with Title IX. You got to get educators together. You got to show them who's doing it right. And for anyone doing it wrong, you got to pull government funding. That's how universities respond. And so I do think there's a lot of tools in government to respond to this moment. And it is no longer an acceptable excuse for people to not fully know what anti-Semitism is or isn't on the college campus. Professors separating Jews out from classes, trying to call it free speech to talk about supporting Hamas and how exhilarating Hamas is. These are things that require consequences and bold moral leadership. And I think the conversation we're having is the right one, but this has been brewing for quite some time for anyone paying attention. And my heart really does go out to college students right now navigating really difficult situations. Oh. I spoke to a group of Columbia students last night, and I will say, I said to them, first and foremost, right, your Hillel quote, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? Put your life mask on, find people who get it, hang out with them, find support in them. It's okay to first keep yourself safe, find the people who are going to give you what you need in this moment, and then organize. And I think for those of you in relationship with and having kids or whomever in school right now, it is a hard time to be Jewish. And we don't want people, we don't want the outcome of this for us to have to hide our Jewishness. We want to be able to celebrate it and move forward, but it's going to take all of us some coordinated efforts to combat anti-Semitism in our schools together. But I want to say I'm surprised, but if anyone's been paying attention to the last several years, it's not surprising. It's just hard to accept.
Joel, do you want to say something?
I mean, the only thing I'll add to Sheila's, very eloquent points there is, I served in local government elected in Maryland, and we have seen a spike in anti-Semitism, even in Montgomery County, Maryland, which has a significant Jewish population and a lot of elected Jewish officials, a real rise, a spike, public displays of Nazi swastikas. I have three teenage daughters. They see the anti-Semitic, jargon everywhere in their schools. They are on the front lines. They're directly affected. I feel like October 7th facilitated a spike in anti-Semitism. It's like the Band-Aid got ripped off, maybe holding back a bit. Now it's exploded globally. And we are truly in a new dynamic. It used to be from a progressive perspective that we could easily beat up the far right and white supremacists and Donald Trump for being the anti-Semite that he is. And therefore we have the moral high ground. I grew up in Squirrel Hill, as Hanan mentioned. Tree of Life is a synagogue I hung out at all the time. My parents were there for Shabbat Friday night before the mass murders. And we knew who that opponent was. Well, now, here we are facing a challenge on our side, on the left, and we're seeing it spiked across, and there are no answers right now in the progressive side for how to deal with it. There really are none. And, I feel as if we're leaving our kids in many ways to fend for themselves in this, and that's also very troubling, as well as a father, not just as an organizer and someone working in public policy.
Thanks, Joel. I want to get to a couple of the questions. We have a question from Martin Raffel who asks, how big is the Beyond the Pale left? How big is it? Let's say within the political space and maybe even within the Jewish space. Joel, do you want to take the political space? Sheila, do you want to take the Jewish space? And maybe you might disagree with that notion, but what's your take?
Oh, no. I think that's a great question. That's a really smart question. That was something at J Street and on the Sanders campaign we always wrestled with. I'll be very open about this. From where I sat, if you're an anti-Zionist and you believe that the state of Israel shouldn't exist, you're out of the tent. if you're in a Jewish space on foreign policy and you're advocating for peace and diplomacy and aggressive American diplomacy to get a two-state solution, which I truly believe still to this day is the vision that we need to have. And I know a lot of Israelis who think the same way. That's the vision. But there are people on the left right now who basically say eliminate the state of Israel, one state or no state, anti-Zionism, and they're out. They're beyond the pale. And interestingly, a lot of alumni of J Street and a lot of alumni of Bernie Sanders campaigns over the years wrote letters to J Street leadership and to Senator Sanders complaining that they're not supporting of a ceasefire. Well, complain away. That's just not where the organizations are, and that's not where Senator Sanders has been up till now. And I think that those are positions that are outside the pale until Israel is able to really deal with its reality in front of it. We have to give it the space to deal with it, but we have to be a friend and ensure that the end game of peace, reconciliation is not forgotten in the midst of this war. But there are people outside and they're pretty identifiable.
I think the only thing I'm going to add to this is I still think there's a lot we don't know. I think we're still in the beginning of this and not at the end. And, you know, obviously I'm talking about my visceral emotional reaction to October 7th. I also know people who are in Gaza, and particularly for people who have more relationships in Gaza right now, their world is still moving and changing every moment. It's not necessarily the right time to be engaging fully in the conversations that need to happen because we're not through the trauma yet. And so I would just say, I don't think we should be making excuses for anti-Semitism. It's not ignorance. It's not misinformation. It's anti-Semitism. And I think there's still work to be done when people are ready. And when we're further through this, and in a way, we know that the real magic of work happens when we're not in the middle of a crisis, and we are. And so I just want to give us all permission here as we're moving so quickly, which we should be doing, in understanding that a lot of the people who are most deeply connected to what's happening right now are not yet in a position to be able to fully engage with the full thoughtfulness that they could bring to the conversation. And that also has to be okay.
Muriel Goldsmith asked, a couple of Israelis have written to me that they think this is going to change the relationship between American Jews and Israel. Do you think so? And if so, in what way? Sheila, you want to maybe tackle that? And Joel, I'll get you another question.
Sure. I mean, I guess we don't know yet. And I think a surge in anti-Semitism is going to make people feel even more deeply connected to the need for Israel. And I think we just saw like an outpouring of support, over $500 million that Jewish Federations of North America raised. I think forever there is going to be an October 6th that was different, and an October 7th in Israel that has forever changed that country and who Israel will be and who the people will be. But I also think there's now an October 6th for Jews around the globe and an October 7th for Jews and what that's going to mean for our Jewishness. There's a war happening in Israel and there's another war happening right here and for Jews everywhere navigating this. And so I think we're going to rely even more deeply on one another. I think we're going to need one another. And I think we're going to also need to see what happens in government there. Like there has to be a path forward in which people are confident in the government in Israel, in which people feel like they're getting the information with empathy in the way that they need in this moment. And I do think we're going to see some changes on the horizon. I don't know exactly what they are, but that will also impact that relationship.
Joel, earlier you talked about this notion of like a binary between oppressor and oppressed. And True Wolf said, how should progressive anti-racist Jews ask for support from progressive allies? Jews are seen as white oppressors and Palestinians are people of color. How do you navigate sort of that dimension? Have you found that apparent in your conversations over the last month or so?
It's a great question. Thank you. And I found myself actually oddly having these discussions on TV interviews and these debates with folks who want to make that claim. And it may sound defensive, but I'm going to use it anyways. And you say that this notion that somehow there's this white colonist implant somehow just got shoved into the heart of the Middle East is so disconnected from the truth and the reality. And I think to Sheila's point, like there is an education deficit. Look, we all know there's an education deficit domestically. We have seen it full force when it comes to Holocaust education and people even knowing when they claim genocide, that Israel's quote, committing genocide, what that is intending to do to the Jewish ear. That is an intentional gaslighting, aggressive language, period. I do think it's crucial to lay out facts. Like, for example, a quarter of Israelis are Palestinian citizens of Israel. The significant chunk of the Jewish citizens of Israel have roots in Mizrahi families and Sephardic families, and get your head out of the sand. This is not the right frame, but that is a frame. And let's be honest, that is a frame right now that is very dominant in progressive spaces and in certainly in international spaces about oppressor versus oppressed. And so we're going to have to come up with more than just the factual argument. And part of that is finding an accommodation, finding an actual way forward, some type of peaceful reconciliation. You know, it's out there. Look, Israel has peace with multiple Arab countries. It has relations with the Palestinian Authority. Thorny is all, definitely difficult, but there has to be some path forward. There has to be a day after scenario. You know, when I served at the State Department, the big flaw in our invasion in Iraq wasn't just the invasion, which of course was based upon, from my perspective, a series of lies. I don't think I'm unique in that. But it was also a failure to have a phase four, as we call it in military speak, a day after post-conflict planning, where there really was an actual political endgame that you're shooting for, because war is a function of political objectives. And so what are the political objectives? And those need to be clear, and they need to allow for a vision of a better future, just like after 73, when there was disengagement with Egypt and ultimately peace that has been tremendously beneficial to Israel's security. That needs to be out there. And that's how we can help reframe this discussion and ensure that we're building alliances. That is not a giveaway. That is not a sellout of Israel. That's an actual objective for those of us who care about Israel's safety and security, to have real security. And we have to make sure that peace is part of that conversation.
One more question. Thank you so much, Joel. I think that's on point. You know, when this war ends, and this is from Anonymous, can there be any coalition with those who have essentially supported trying to stop Israel's effort to end Hamas? I guess the question is, like, especially for you, Sheila, because you lead a major organization, how do you, let's say you are working hand in hand with a specific organization and you've been locked in arms on all these major issues and they've been either silent or, you know, said kind of the wrong thing over the last little bit. How do you maintain that relationship? Do you aim to? Like, what's going to be the status? And I'm mindful, we're just within 4 weeks and it's all very,
Yeah. I think we're asking ourselves this question. I do think there is going to be people we say goodbye to. I mean, with pain, and, you know, that's the right thing. If people can't see our humanity, we don't need to be working arm in arm. And we don't need to be giving a platform to anybody who supports anti-Semitism. And that said, you know, I've been thinking about why Hamas is so popular for young people and, like, just generally. I'm like, who's their PR people, right? How do people what do they have to do for people to hate them the way that I do? And I don't hate anybody, but I hate Hamas. And their PR agent is anti-Semitism. Like, that's it. This has shown who cares about Jews and who doesn't. And we cannot make excuses anymore. And so what I can say is there are still crises in the United States. We're the leading Jewish organization working on fighting for childcare right now. There's a childcare cliff about to happen and millions of children are going to be without childcare. You need us to fight for that. You need us to fight for reproductive rights. You need us to fight for equal pay. We're going to still do that. The question is whether we're going to stay in the spaces we're currently in with everybody who's there, or whether we're going to find the people who love and value and respect us and build something new. And I don't know which it's going to be right now, but I just want to say as we close, on October 7th, I was so, like, I shouldn't have to say grateful, but in retrospect, now I'm grateful. I was grateful that the National Organization of Women put out a statement right away without even talking to us, right? That they knew what was happening was bad and wrong, and they said it. I was grateful that the Drum Major Institute, Martin Luther King III, and Andrea King took a statement out right away. I was grateful that all of the leaders of the March on Washington put out a statement right away. You know, there were people who showed up for us. And I think no matter what, we will be marching arm in arm with people in the fight for collective equity and justice as we move forward. And if that group needs to be smaller, because we don't want to work with people who hate us, so be it. And it's their loss, you know, but we have important work to do here in the United States. We have important work to do in Israel, and we have to make sure to keep moving forward, not losing sight of our moral values, which are crystal clear. And I hope, I really hope that the people we're arm in arm with, that it's a long, long line of people. I really hope. And I am comfortable if anybody who has made anti-Semitic comments or doesn't quite understand the horrors of October 7th, I am comfortable with them no longer being in that space with us. And to the people who, there are a lot of questions that we didn't get to of like politicians and people who we thought were our allies in one space and aren't in another space, this is going to get complicated. There are people who are elected officials who are the best of the best when it comes to like issues on gender around everything else and are not on Israel. And these are things we're going to have to hold and figure out how we move forward. It's okay for us to say, thank you for doing this on the Violence Against Women Act. And, you know, we do not agree or feel seen or heard because of your statement on Israel that was atrocious. And we're not sure we can partner with you moving forward. Like, this is the current debate that I think progressive Zionists are having of when to push people totally out, when to move people along their journey, and what that coalition is going to space look like moving forward. But I have hope. It's certainly going to move forward with the Jews. And the question of who's around the table is still up for debate.
Let us say amen to that. Joel, anything that you would add to Sheila before we wrap?
The only thing I would add, and amen to that, and Sheila, your leadership, is to remember that you're not alone. We are not alone. We have a beautiful history as American Jews of fighting through these hard periods. And we did it through organizing. We did it through establishing organizations. We did it through building up our synagogues, building up our infrastructure. And there are moments when we go big and then we get smaller, but we are together, and we have to speak out. And I think, to me, that's the biggest takeaway that I've gotten from the last several weeks. And overall in this is that if we don't speak and create opportunities for others to speak, no one will speak, and we will wither away in terms of our ability to maintain, as Doug Emhoff says, being proud of being Jewish and publicly so. So I think just continue to speak out. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Speak out, speak your truth. And as Sheila says, some people will disappear, but you'll find new allies in the process, and we will get through this period together. But we have to do it from a position of pride and confidence.
You know, there's a turn of phrase from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, that says, "B'makom she'ein ish hishtadel lehiyot ish," when there is no individual who steps up, you have to strive to be that individual to step up. It's certainly the case, Joel and Sheila, that you've done that in the last few weeks and prior to. And you have an audience of people who feel, I think, a certain degree of comfort and confidence knowing that leaders like you are out there and who are equipped themselves, because they are leaders too, to address the current situation. As murky and as complicated as it sometimes could be, there's some things that aren't complicated and there's some things that aren't murky. And that's defending against what transpired on October 7th, a massacre that unfortunately will, a day that will live in infamy in the minds of Jews for many, many years to come. We thank all of you who joined us today. Please go to sapirjournal.org if you'd like to continue to read. We have a special edition of content related to the war. We're trying to produce things today. Michal Biton wrote a piece earlier today and encourage you to read that. We'll continue to have weekly events over the next little bit. And again, I just want to end with a certain degree of hakarat hatov, deep appreciation to you, Joel, and to you, Sheila, and to all of you for joining us today. Thank you, everybody.